This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land. Tomorrow's Victorian election is looking to be a tight contest, and some pundits think a hung parliament is a real possibility. Perhaps the best-known premier in the country, Labor's Daniel Andrews, is seeking a third term, while the Liberal National Coalition, led by Matthew Guy, is hoping enough Victorians will want to punish the premier for his management of the pandemic and boot him out of office. As Samantha Donovan reports, the election may also show us if support for independent candidates in Australian elections is continuing to grow.
Victorians have been turning up at early voting centres in record numbers this state election. So is that a sign the electorate is keen to give Daniel Andrews a third term?
If you want a bigger economy, not a smaller economy because of Liberal cuts, closures and cancellations, if you want free kinder next year, a properly funded TAFE system, if you want to bring back the SEC, 100% renewable energy, if more nurses and more ambos are important to you, please vote Labor.
Or are Victorians keen for change and getting behind the Liberal National Coalition led by Matthew Guy?
There's a job to do, and it's fixing the health system. It is rewarding hardworking families. It's getting on with restoring our state's pride. You know, I think what you saw was an arrogant and out-of-touch premier who's out of ideas and out of time. I say to Victorians, you can change the government. This Saturday's our chance. Let's not waste it.
Matthew Guy is hoping Victorians angry with the repeated COVID lockdowns will back his bid to be premier. The Liberals are optimistic they can win the key seat of Pakenham, which takes in the sprawling new housing developments of Melbourne's outer southeast. And some voters there clearly want the Labor government out.
Andrews should be gone. Yeah, everybody got sick of being locked up.
No, I just feel they handled the whole COVID thing really badly, and I feel like they've just destroyed so many lives out of something that's turned out to be the flu.
While other Pakenham voters are going to stick with Labor.
Well, I was actually quite happy with how it was handled in trying to decrease numbers and decrease impact on the hospitals.
All of the upgrades of the railway lines, that's great, making Melbourne a much more livable city.
But could independent candidates thwart the ambitions of the major parties to form majority government? The Climate 200 group is backing so-called teals in four Victorian seats, Hawthorne, Kew and Caulfield in inner Melbourne and Mornington, southeast of the city. And there are many other independents standing around the state. The Melbourne Bayside electorate of Goldstein voted in teal independent Zoe Daniel at the federal poll. So were voters in the area likely to back independence at the state level?
I would like to think people think deeper than just switching and changing, you know, see what the political parties actually believe in. And if that's what you believe in, then that's the way you need to vote.
I fear about independents really don't have the clout and the ability to get things done apart to be blockers on issues.
They don't seem to have got as much spark at the state levels or as much support. I thought there would be more warmth about the teals. Round here doesn't seem to have been.
Well, I hope they do well. I think independents are quite good because with Labor and Liberal, you've got two people that have to stick to some ideas and have to stick to some ideologies. With independents, they can sway around a little bit more and they can have some different opinions.
And it's not just independent candidates who may shake things up this Victorian election. The Greens are hoping to snatch the inner Melbourne seats of Richmond, Northcote and Albert Park from Labor.
Samantha Donovan reporting from Melbourne there. And we did invite the Premier Daniel Andrews and the Liberal leader Matthew Guy to appear on AM this week for interviews. Mr. Andrews declined. Mr. Guy's office didn't respond. George Megalogenis is an author and journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And he joined me earlier. George, this election isn't just one fight. It's many fought on many fronts. So should we be surprised that leaders are shying away from interviews in the mass media? And should we be concerned?
I think we shouldn't be surprised, but we should be disappointed. The idea that a premier and an opposition leader, the leader of an alternate government, can't turn up on AM or any of the sort of national media forums is concerning to me. But we shouldn't be surprised because I think this particular campaign is clarifying some trends that have been apparent, I think, for at least a decade or more in our federal and state politics. Sort of micro-targeting of audiences, micro-messaging, and sort of ground games that are more like guerrilla campaigns, even for the incumbent, where a sort of general interview with someone like you or with Sabra Lane or Sally Sara for World Today, there are too many risks. And the risks are questions that aren't anticipated, and the risks are grabs that might come out of that interview that are closer to scrutiny than the repetition of party lines.
Mm. You wrote this week, the ingredients for a once-in-a-generation upset are seemingly in place. How so?
Yeah, good call, seemingly, because there's about three or four things that remind me of the 1999 election, and there's one key difference. The number of seats that the Labor government take into this campaign after the redistribution of boundaries is identical to the number of seats Jeff Kennett took into the 1999 election. And those of you in the audience who can remember back to 1999, this was going to be another landslide for the Kennett government. But hiding in plain sight was this major revolt in the regions, which Labor had carefully pieced together. And on the night, the government lost its majority. And after a special election was held in an outer metropolitan seat, Frankston East, Labor picked up that seat. And the final seat count was 43 government, 42 opposition and 3 on the crossbench. And Steve Brax was able to form minority government. It'd be a huge shock if Matthew Guy and the coalition were able to form majority government after Saturday night. But there is the possibility of a minority government. And a lot of people on the Labor side are talking about minority government. That means that they've lost at least 12 seats. But, and this is where the similarities end, whilst Daniel Andrews has the same sort of profile in the sort of Victorian mind as Jeff Kennett, he's been around for a while. He's the longest serving leader, either federal, state or territory at the moment, as Kennett was in 1999. And the state and the government and basically the entire conversation in Victoria has been around this one guy. It's a one Dan state. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in the community that people are fed up with him, as they were with Kennett in 99. But the differences, and there are a couple of structural differences. One, the Liberal Party in Melbourne starts from a much weakened position than Labor was in 1999. And the other one is they've got a recycled leader. They don't have a clean skin, as Steve Brax was in 1999. And there's a big question around the crossbench. This time around, that's where we'll all be watching on the night. Who loses seats? Government. Even opposition looks like it's going to lose some seats. It's a bit nervous about a couple of seats of its own, and both the Greens and Independents, Till and left-leaning Independents this time in Victoria, are all in with a shot.
Mm, so the crossbench, the Independents, that will be one of the big signals out of this election for where politics is going nationally. Is there anything else?
Yeah. Well, just back on that point, the question is the two-party system. So if there's a mood for change, if people are fed up with the government but can't bring themselves to transfer sufficient number of seats to either bring you a minority coalition government or a majority coalition government, then that's an issue not just for the current Liberal and National leaders in Victoria, but it's a fundamentally more a structural issue. And if I were to summarise it in a single voter, it's basically people under 30 who tend now, when you check what their primary voting intentions are, they're more likely to vote Green than they are Liberal, and they're as likely to vote Green as Labor. So it's about a third primary voter amongst younger voters. Now that group, especially in Victoria, is dominant in some of the city electorates. So that's where the two-party system is in mortal danger, I'd probably argue. That's why I think everybody nationally, they'll all be watching this for any signal, especially in inner city seats, that the major parties are no longer viable.
That's author and journalist George Megalogenis. Well, one of the more disturbing revelations that led to a Royal Commission into aged care was the poor quality of food being dished up to many elderly residents. It prompted the federal government to offer a $10 daily top-up for nursing home residents' meals. Even so, many still complain of substandard food. And now that the government supplement, worth $350 million in all, is being rolled into general industry funding, critics fear the quality will further deteriorate. Annie Guest reports.
It's lunchtime at this Sunshine Coast nursing home, where there's cold meat and salad and also cooked meals for the residents.
I enjoy the meals, yeah. No, I think they're pretty good, actually. You know, it's quite a big organisation, and I think they cope well. We get quite a bit of variety.
You know, yeah, but the food's all right. The food's fine.
Do you like the meals here? What do you think of them?
There's nothing wrong with the meals here. It's good food. It really is.
Well presented. So very good indeed. Very happy.
Unfortunately, in many other nursing homes, the feedback isn't so good. A nationwide survey of residents' families by Flinders University has found 85% of respondents have concerns, ranging from food quality to a lack of assistance at meal times. It doesn't surprise Dietitians Australia president Tara DeVersey.
When it comes to aged care facilities, our dietitians aren't always seeing the quality of food improving since the Royal Commission into aged care. So our dietitians report that in the aged care facilities that they're working in, sometimes they're seeing food that's of poor quality or potentially they're not meeting the needs of the resident.
A $10 per resident per day food-focused supplement was introduced after the Royal Commission, but that supplement is now being rolled into general funding, something that's got a lot of people worried. One of those is Dr. Sarah Russell from Aged Care Matters.
It's very concerning to me because one of the big things that comes out of the Royal Commission, that comes from residents all the time, is their disappointment with the food in aged care homes. And this money was really meant to be directed to improving the quality of their meals. And now that it's gone into general funding, we have even less idea how they're spending it.
In a statement, the Department of Health and Aged Care says there's now greater transparency. And the government is also developing a new nutrition standard. Tara DeVersey wants it to include regular dietitian visits.
We'd like to see the supplement being mandated to be spent on food, and we'd also like to see a dietitian within every nursing home once a year so they can do that nutrition assessment, provide recommendations and guidance about how you can spend that $10 per person per day, and that's at the minimum.
But the aged care regulator recently told Senate Estimates more nursing homes say they've increased spending on food. And Tim Hicks from the Aged and Community Care Providers Association agrees.
Aged care providers are already spending more on care and services than they receive from government. So the issue here is ensuring there's enough funding to cover all the costs of service delivery, food, nursing, personal care. The important thing is that there will continue to be measurement of how much aged care providers are spending on food.
He says the quality of nursing home food is improving overall, but he agrees action should be taken where that's not the case.
Any guest reporting. West Australians are bracing for another scorching, bone-dry summer. While La Niña keeps dumping rain on the east coast, WA's emergency services and the Bureau of Meteorology are expecting an increased risk of heat waves and bushfires in the west. Communities still recovering from last year's destructive fires in the south of the state are again preparing for dangerous conditions. John Daly reports.
That is amazing.
In February last year, fast-moving bushfires tore through Perth's hills, destroying 86 homes. Jody Kant's family home near the town of Gidjiganup was among them. And the trauma of that day hasn't left her.
It came very quickly. It was very intense for all of us. It'll just be something that stays with us and becomes part of who we are for the rest of our lives.
While eastern states face floods, the west is preparing for another blistering hot summer. The Bureau of Meteorology's latest outlook for summer predicts higher than average temperatures, strong winds, and higher risk of heat waves. That paints a similar picture to the conditions during last year's summer. Jodie Kant says her community is on alert.
I guess from my perspective, I could say, well, I don't have a lot to lose that's precious as far as material possessions go because I lost them all last time. So our focus was very much on our animals and our, you know, and people, getting ourselves and our animals out.
WA's Department of Fire and Emergency Services is also steeling itself for a big bushfire season. Commissioner Darren Clem says the conditions forecast for the end of summer are concerning.
It really speaks to January through to March being far more hotter than average, and that coupled up with discussion around stronger winds, does really present bushfire risk for us, and those are those really challenging days that we have every summer, it must be said.
Mr Clem says WA's fire season has become longer and longer over the years.
We're seeing the season extend longer into April and sometimes June.
While La Nina is drenching the East Coast, University of New South Wales Professor of Climate Dynamics, Matthew England, says La Nina doesn't have much of an impact in the West. Instead, there's a significant longer-term drying trend in the populated south of WA.
We've seen it before, and it's only about a year ago that La Nina summer we had that very characteristic pattern of dry and hot conditions, bad bushfire season, and wet flooding rains over the east.
Jodie Cant is still recovering from the last fire season and preparing for the next.
You know, you can't fight nature, so all it makes me think is, are we prepared? Is our insurance up to date? Have I done everything I can? Do we have a plan? And you just face it with the resilience that, you know, I think West Australians are pretty well known for.
That's Perth Hills resident Jodie Cant, John Daly reporting. Authorities in Ukraine are racing to reconnect the country's power grid following a wave of deadly Russian attacks. Operating theatres have been plunged into darkness and millions of people have been shivering through freezing temperatures. The Kremlin has denied targeting civilian infrastructure, but it says if Kyiv wants to end the suffering, it'll have to give ground. Europe correspondent Nick Doll reports.
In a hospital in Kyiv, surgeons are trying to save a child's life. Heart surgery is challenging enough, but these doctors have had to contend with a blackout mid-procedure. Some hold torches, others rely on their headlamps. They have access to generators, but they only power the most vital equipment, and they only last as long as the fuel supply. Dr. Ilya Yemets from Kyiv's Children's Heart Hospital says he's never operated in such tough conditions.
The most terrible situation that I ever seen in my surgical life because of stopped electricity, stopped the water supply.
Ukraine says it had to shut down all four of its nuclear power plants as a result of Russian strikes, but the reactors are gradually being reconnected. Satellite images of the country show much of it blacked out. The only thing darker is the Black Sea itself. The government set up so-called invincibility shelters, buildings and tents with heating and hot drinks, giving freezing Ukrainians a chance to warm up. It's the second day we've been without power and food, this woman says. More than 60 children are waiting for food and we can't prepare anything unless the power gets fixed. The kids haven't eaten since yesterday. We need help. Kyiv resident Oksana had to walk around the city looking for mobile reception to let her family know she's okay. She's trying not to let the power cuts get her down. I want to say it's become clear now what bastards they are. But they can't break millions of Ukrainians during a blackout. We're ready to endure anything. Kyiv has no water, no power, but no Russians either, which is the most important thing. The Kremlin has denied targeting civilian infrastructure, but it says if Ukraine wants to make the situation easier on civilians, it should give in to its demands, although exactly what they are remains unclear. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says responsibility rests with Vladimir Putin.
Because of him, babies, their parents and grandparents are freezing in the dark. And I strongly condemn these barbaric attacks. They are war crimes.
Ms von der Leyen says the EU is preparing a ninth round of economic sanctions.
We are working hard to hit Russia where it hurts, to blunt even further its capacity to wage war on Ukraine. We will not rest until Ukraine has prevailed over Putin and his unlawful and barbaric war.
Back in the operating theatre in Kyiv, there's some good news. The heart operation was successful and the three-month-old child is alive. But the world it's been born into is looking more and more troubled.
Europe correspondent Nick Doll there. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Electric vehicles are about to become cheaper in Australia, with the government securing Senate support for tax cuts it promised during the election. Today, electric vehicle expert Gail Broadbent on what the changes mean and whether there'll now be a tsunami in sales. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.